I'm Roger Baker, Executive Director of the Stratfor Center for Applied Geopolitics at RAIN, a global center of excellence for geopolitical intelligence and analysis. Learn how you can put geopolitics to work for your organization at RAINnetwork.com.
Hello, and welcome to RAIN's Essential Geopolitics podcast. My name is Emma Kami, and for today's episode, I'll be speaking with RAIN's Eurasia analyst, Matthew Orr, about the implications of the recent terrorist attack in the Moscow Concert Hall. Hi, Matthew.
Hey, Emma. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you on the podcast. Can you tell us what the latest updates are regarding the attack?
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, since the attack took place on Friday evening, we've seen Russian authorities detain numerous people, involved in the attack. First of all, we're talking about the actual believed perpetrators of the attack, four individuals from Tajikistan. All kinds of videos were circulating on Telegram and other places showing the torture of these individuals. And of course, they were then brought into actual Russian courtrooms and shown with clear signs of torture. One of the reasons that would be, politically pertinent is that there's actually a movement within Russia to change the country's constitution to somehow allow the return of the death penalty, which at least formally has not existed in Russia for many years. But of course, there's a strong desire for justice and for retribution against these terrorists. Of course, on top of that, we've seen the detention of several other, maybe even over a dozen other individuals believed to be related to this incident. For example, the people who are believed to have sold them the car that they used to perpetrate the attack, the people who rented out apartments to them. There's also notably signs of actual raids by Russian security forces, led by Russian security forces, but all the way over in Tajikistan, working with their partners in that country, and of course the Tajik security services to interrogate and question people believed to have any relationship to these individuals. But otherwise, the biggest reaction that we've seen so far has been really on the rhetorical side. At least in my estimation, as of Wednesday, March 27th, the Russian government is still very much in the kind of the phase where they haven't clearly decided what their response is going to be. This has really gone on a long time. Remember that Putin took over 19 hours to make a statement about the attack, and when he did not mentioned the what appears to be the clear perpetrator of the attack, the Islamic State of Khorasan Province, which is active out of Afghanistan primarily, and instead spent most of his public comments talking about an alleged Ukrainian trace to the attack. This was all based off of the idea that the terrorists began to move, or rather escaped from Moscow in the direction of Belarus and Ukraine. The problem is that being some sort of criteria to tie the attack to the Ukrainians is of course extremely dubious on numerous grounds. One obvious one is that it appears that the perpetrators didn't have much of an operational plan for what they were going to do after this attack. In fact, they used the exact same vehicle that they arrived to then leave, which is a clear sign of little expectation to survive for long after the attack. Moreover, this attack was on the northwest part of Moscow, and it would have been natural to, otherwise they would have to drive back across the city of Moscow into a heavily policed presence, or on major highways in other directions. And so, moving in a westward direction is kind of the only logical direction to flee towards in that circumstance. But then even since Putin's public comments, we've seen time and time and time again, so many Russian officials of all ranks and statures, most notably, of course, the Siloviki, the high-ranking members of Russia's security services, mainly the FSB director Bortnikov and the Secretary of the Security Council Patrushev, have repeatedly continued to make public statements tying the attack to Ukraine and de-emphasizing the role of ISKP and Islamist in the situation. basically the idea is that they recognize formally that it was Islamists who committed the attack, but all of the Russian narrative and media response has been about the alleged, finding the alleged organizers, and here is where there's this very clear attempt to draw in the Ukrainians. But otherwise, we're seeing security crackdowns inside of Russia on suspected terrorists, right? A lot of preemptive actions, people who were maybe of questionable status. And of course, we're seeing major attacks, persecution in cases of discrimination of Central Asians, human rights abuses, all kinds of complaints that are coming into rights organizations monitoring this, basically of Central Asians being detained and in some cases even tortured merely for being Central Asian. And so we're also seeing kind of this wave of displeasure over the presence of Central Asian migration migrants in Russia, but otherwise, again, we haven't really reached the phase where it's very clear, Russia's concrete response measures. But I think that phase is probably going to commence relatively soon.
And why is Russia tying it to Ukraine exactly? Like, does Russia think that these claims will be believed internationally, or is this positioning more of an internal kind of PR move?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think you're hinting at the right answer here, which is I think that the Ukraine angle, although they will have to, as they more and more buy into this to a certain extent, they will push this narrative internationally. But primarily, I think it's serving a domestic political purpose, and then having to internationalize it and defend it on the international stage is really more of a consequence, rather than the direct cause. But yes, I think that the idea is that, if in the eyes of the Kremlin broadly, they see this attack as something that risks fundamentally undermining what they see as Russia's core pursuit of its interests right now, which are in Ukraine, right? Russia has major strategic geopolitical goals that it's pursuing there, and having to divert resources from the Ukraine war, whether it be Rosgvardia National Guard personnel or FSB personnel who are detailed to things related to Ukraine, or even just from a budgetary standpoint, anything about military equipment, etc., other federal bureaucratic resources, right? All of these elements, right? From their point of view, having to do a massive kind of redeployment to internal issues in Russia or the Central Asian frontier would seem to be a massive, redeployment of resources away from this much more pressing and ultimately in the long term geopolitically significant goal. And so in that light, right, what the Russians want to do is basically say, any pain and suffering that you're feeling right now, the best way that we can respond to that is by actually making sure that we accomplish our war efforts in Ukraine. And so the idea is that the Russian people are already conditioned through propaganda to want to try to find some Western angle, Ukrainian angle. In fact, that's really how the Kremlin has been framing things vis-a-vis propaganda internally for at least over a decade, probably longer at this point, which is that ultimately so many of Russia's problems are related to U.S. foreign policy and the mistakes of U.S. foreign policy. And, in that environment, they certainly want Russians to believe that the Ukrainians and ultimately the Americans are somehow behind this, because they feel that is politically more favorable to them and strategically, or it's less dangerous than strategically more in their interests. And so now that we've seen these high-ranking Russian officials buy into this, I think it's somewhat doubtful that that's going to be significantly walked back. Yes, the FSB director has been very clear that yes, they do clearly recognize that it was Islamist terrorists. That is really about how showing that they are still adequately receiving some information, of course, and that's also important. But ultimately, yes, domestically, it's of extreme importance to all, right? You can't let, as Churchill, I think, said, you can't let a good crisis go to waste. And so from the Kremlin's point of view, they need to use this crisis in a way that's beneficial to their interests, not to inadvertently lock themselves into a response that's actually, you know, counter to those interests or counter to those desires. And so I think that this definitely is intended to open the space for more leverage to ask for greater sacrifices of the Russian people vis-a-vis the war in Ukraine, you know, not even if those don't necessarily have to materialize within, say, the next 3 months. The idea is that you're conditioning the people to have one more very strong example of why such measures could ultimately be justified.
And what about when it comes to actually responding to the believed Islamist terrorists? How is Russia likely to react, I guess? And will their kind of more PR efforts get in the way of what natural reaction they would have had?
Yeah, really, really good question. I think that they, right, so that everything I said is obviously valid, but what's also going on here is that, that being said, they do have to respond to the actual ISKP threat. The problem is that they confront certain constraints in how they actually can do that. The biggest problem is that we're talking about millions of Central Asians who live in Russia constantly. Something like at least over a million Tajiks who are Tajik citizens who reside in Russia. Then you add on all of the Tajiks who have received Russian citizenship but reside in Russia. And then you add on all the other Central Asians who live in Russia in some status. And then you add on all of the millions of Central Asians who are, you know, have various statuses and are moving back and forth between Russia and Central Asia relatively constantly. And you're talking about such a large flow of people who are very significant to Russia's economy. First of all, right, we're talking about people who work in construction jobs, a very important sector right now when the government is trying to, you know, offer maximally, you know, low-cost housing and favorable mortgage incentives to Russians, right, so that they're more likely to start families and have children, et cetera. You know, really in critical work, especially in an environment where Russia's demographics are already poor. This is really the solution to the labor shortage, as men of fighting age are off fighting in Ukraine, and so that's a huge constraint that really Russia has to think about in its response. On the one hand, you could say, oh, Russia would want to, you know, limit the inflows of these individuals, or is going to lean hard into increasing formal requirements for them to cross into Russia or things like that. But that has two constraints, right? A, the economic one, and then B, also there's also this idea that as you complicate the lives of these Central Asians, you know, they're more likely to, you know, feel discriminated against in Russia, adopt negative views towards Russia. If they're ultimately forced to go back to Central Asia and there they can't find jobs, then you actually are feeding this pool of people who could be radicalized and may want to actually you know, may feel greater sympathies for terrorists. And so particularly in an environment where these Central Asian states, I think Tajikistan is one of the most dependent countries on remittances in the world, because something like over 30%, I believe, of their GDP actually comes from remittances from Russia. And if that economy breaks down, and Tajikistan's economy breaks down, then that has huge implications for Russia. But that all being said, yes, they do have to stake concrete measures. I think that they are going to be, a lot of it is going to be, you know, trying to enforce existing Russian laws, right? Central Asians who are residing in Russia illegally, there's definitely going to be massively increased checks of their documentation, deportations of people there illegally, things like that. Of course, the government's going to keep an eye on that to make sure that it doesn't get out of hand, but absolutely to satisfy public desires, and particularly, obviously, people on counterterrorism's radar, I mean, those people are definitely going to be moved against. We could see a formal tightening of some requirements for Central Asians, but that's probably going to be a relatively longer-term process if it ever happens. really, I think the Russian government's idea is to wait this out and not have to take drastic measures of that kind. And then I think really the biggest part of Russia's response is going to be in Central Asia itself, where it's going to say this is a huge reminder of how important close relationships with these governments are. And I think the first thing that they need to do is make sure that the kinds of raids that they're doing in Tajikistan, right, through cooperation with security partners of the partner governments of the region, they really need to make sure that all of those relationships are well oiled and able to work right now, and of course in the future, because really there's not a clear sign that this threat is going away to Russia. I don't necessarily think that Russia can take measures that can eliminate the threat of these kinds of attacks at their core, just because, again, the volumes of people that we're talking about, and the unlikelihood of canceling the fundamental mechanisms that allow that to happen, right? Visa-free regimes between Russia and Central Asia, visa-free regimes for up to 60 or 90 days for even other countries, such as Turkey, that at least in this case appeared to have also been a country that the perpetrators were traveling to, right? Those things are unlikely to change. And so in that reality, Russia's going to have to find smaller additional ways on the margin to deal with this. The last thing I'll say is that, yes, there is also the possibility of Russia responding with strikes against the believed perpetrators. That would primarily be, of course, in Afghanistan, although in theory, some activity in Syria is also possible. The problem is that it's not exactly clear what the target is to strike there, and a strong belief that actually would have much of a material effect on degrading ISKP's ability to do this. And so, you know, if it's mainly a kind of an informational thing, then, you know, it serves the purpose of only further fueling into ISKP's existing propaganda, and is unlikely to have a significant effect. And so really, whether or not we see those strikes will be entirely determined off whether or not there's actually, anything worth hitting. Otherwise, it's going to be mainly just potential PR actions in this regard. But yeah, in any case, I think that these measures, in the context of the war in Ukraine, some of them are going to be quiet, some of them are going to be demonstrative, but at least in the government's eyes, the main thing is that these measures need to not fundamentally degrade or threaten Russia's ability to pursue the war in Ukraine, because that would set up an incentive structure that the Kremlin would see as highly problematic and unfavorable to them.
Well, thank you so much, Matthew. Really appreciate you coming on and sharing your insights. You can read more geopolitical insights and analyses from RAIN by subscribing to one of RAIN's risk intelligence products. Our suite of products and solutions allow clients to access the insights and analyses they need to make more informed decisions. You can sign up or learn more at our website, rainnetwork.com. That's RANE network.com. I'm Emma Kalmi. Thanks for listening.